Good morning, members. I think we'll call the meeting to order. My name is Greg Hubinger. I'm with the Legislative Coordinating Commission, which is a joint House-Senate agency that provides administrative support to the House and the Senate. I think I'll start by asking each of you to introduce yourselves and the organization that you're with and perhaps who appointed you. Peter, do you want to start?
Sure. My name is Peter Sadowski. I'm a member of the Minnesota Chamber on the Education Committee. I'm also small. I run a small business, a medical device company, and I'm a governor's appointee.
My name is John Keller. I'm the executive director and supervising legal attorney at the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota, Oficina Legal, a nonprofit in St. Paul and working in southern Minnesota, doing basically immigration representation, education, and legislative work. I'm very happy to be here. I'm glad that we're getting started, and I was appointed by the Senate as a public member.
State Senator Joe Gimsey out of Wilmer, Minnesota. I was appointed by the Senate Republican Caucus.
Patricia Torres-Ray, I represent District 62, Southeast Minneapolis in the Senate, and I was appointed by the Senate.
Representative Rod Hamilton, District 22B, appointed by the House.
Paul Gardner, District 53A in the House, appointed by the Speaker of the House.
Joe Swedberg with Hormel Foods, Austin, Minnesota, is appointed by the Governor.
Thank you very much. As I indicated before the meeting started, my job is to convene the meeting, conduct elections, and then let you guys take over the meeting. Just as background, during the 2007 session, legislation was passed that added some responsibilities to the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and a copy of that provision in the statutes is in your folder, and it relates to ethnic heritage and new Americans. That same language gave some responsibility or authority to the LCC to establish a working group to carry out those duties. In June, the commission met and adopted a resolution creating this working group. Copy of that resolution is also in your packets. That same resolution authorized the leadership of the House and Senate to appoint both members of the legislature and public members, some after being nominated by the governor. And that action has resulted in your presence here. The first duty is to elect co-chairs. So at this point, I would accept nominations for the positions of co-chair. They have to be, according to the resolution, a member of the Senate and a member of the House. Is there a nomination?
I will nominate Senator Patricia Torres-Ray.
We have a nomination for co-chair from the Senate of Senator Torres-Ray. Are there any other nominations? If not,
I would nominate Representative Hamilton as the Republican, or
as the House member.
House member, excuse me.
We have a nomination of Representative Hamilton as the House co-chair. We'll take that as one motion then. Senator Torres-Ray and Representative Hamilton as the two co-chairs. Are there any other nominations? Nominations are closed. Those in favor of that motion, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
The motion is adopted. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. You have to start us off?
Yes.
On the gun.
We're going to call this meeting to order. Thank you. Thank you to our staff, and thank you to members for being here. This is really a wonderful opportunity for us to come together to address some issues that are of concern, and thank you for electing me to co-chair. I am honored to serve with Representative Hamilton, and I would like to ask Representative Hamilton to also address the group and the audience. I look forward to work with you to define the priorities for this group, and with your support, we will be defining priorities for this committee that will truly address issues of concern and priorities for the state of Minnesota.
Well, thank you, and I'm also very honored and privileged to be able to be a co-chair and a member of this group. And it was interesting, myself and my good friend Mariano, who is with the Immigration Freedom Network, we were talking about this about 3 years ago, wasn't it? about 3 years ago, he was in my office, and we were scratching up on the board as far as different goals and different, you know, things that we wanted to see accomplished. And here about 3 years later, it's starting to come to light, so we're very excited. So I appreciate being a part of this as well.
As we move forward, the group will determine the priorities for this commission and will determine the issues, will identify the issues that will become the priority. Just as a reminder, we're going to be looking at really a comprehensive set of priorities for the state that really address our heritage and our needs to respond to the demographic changes in the state of Minnesota and look at the impact of these demographic changes in terms of growth and businesses and education and healthcare, but also to look at how do we build on the incredible heritage that is part of this state. So it's both to look at enhancing the opportunities that we currently have and looking at how to resolve some of the challenges that we have. So to that effect, we have invited today our state demographer because we thought it was going to be very important that to build this foundation, we needed to have that information in front of us. So that was our first attempt to look at, you know, what is that we're dealing with in terms of demographics? How do we understand the context of our work within the facts that exist? And so I would like to invite our state demographer to please. Come to the table. Before we start, I don't know if members will have a question with respect to. I don't have a lot of answers, Representative Hamilton. I think we're starting this process, and so this is going to be our collective effort to shape this. We thought that it would be important for us to really look at, you know, demographic growth and to. Review these facts and then have a conversation as to where do we go from here, how do we define our goals and expectations. So unless you have a question, we would like to proceed with the presentation. Welcome, and please introduce yourself and let us know about your presentation, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Mr. members of the study team. My name is Tom Gillespie. I'm the state demographer in Minnesota in the Minnesota Department of Administration, and I have prepared some materials at the request of the LCC on the new American population, alternative definitions, and the trends and characteristics, as well as some of the driving forces. What is causing change in Minnesota? Here we go. Let's see. Wait a minute. Okay. Minnesota, and there are various ways that we can define the new Americans in the United States and in Minnesota, but looking in general at immigration and at the foreign-born population, we generally tend to rank around the middle of states in terms of the level of movement as well as the proportion of our population that is foreign-born. In 2006, Minnesota ranked 25th in the foreign-born population. We ranked 21st in total population. We had 6.6% of our population was born in another country, which was approximately half of the national rate at 12.5%. Minnesota ranks 20th in total direct immigration and approximately 25th in total population growth. So in terms of population growth, immigration, and the foreign-born population, we sort of rank in the middle of states in the United States. There are a few states that have very large numbers of people moving there from other countries. Largely, these are coastal states, oftentimes referred to as gateway states, such as California, Texas, Florida, New York, and states such as that. Minnesota is not one of these. We are in the middle of the states in the country. If we can divide think about the new Americans in a variety of ways, and just some that we oftentimes see reference to in terms of immigration. These are people who move directly to Minnesota from another country and attain legal permanent status. In 2006, we had a little bit over 18,000 people who moved directly to Minnesota as from another country, as with Minnesota as their stated residence, and these people also attained legal permanent status in the United States. Another way of thinking about the population is the foreign-born population, which includes all the people who were born in another country. The United States Census Bureau has collected statistics on the foreign-born population almost since the beginning of this country. In 2006, Minnesota had an estimated 370,000 people who were born in another country, but that also includes 27,000 people who were born of American parents and are American citizens because of that, but their parents were posted overseas at the time. We can also think of new American communities, and I receive a number of questions that want to go beyond the population that moved here directly from another country and also think about their children. And so if we add about another 127,000 children, that comes up to a total of the foreign-born population plus their children amounts to about 500,000 people in Minnesota estimated in 2006. We also receive a large number of questions concerning the unauthorized population and unauthorized migration to Minnesota and to the United States. There are relatively few estimates of this population. The one that I think most demographers will point to as being the higher quality estimates come from the Pew Hispanic Center, which estimates Minnesota at somewhere between about 75,000 and 100,000 people in 2005. Other states in this range of population include Wisconsin, Ohio, Utah, and Connecticut. We are not one of the larger states in their estimate, but we do, according to their estimates, have some people who are here as unauthorized residents. If we look at the historical pattern of the foreign-born population, and go back really much beyond where most of us can remember, and since we are also about to celebrate Minnesota's sesquicentennial, 150 years, we have seen an increase in the foreign-born population since the early 70s. But 1970 represented the lowest level in the foreign-born population numerically since 1870. That we saw a dramatic increase in the foreign-born population during the latter part of the 1800s and peaking in 1910 at nearly 550,000 people. And then that population declined as immigration was more restricted to the United States and the existing foreign-born population aged, declining to a low point in 1970, and we have seen increases since 1970. Minnesota's current foreign-born population is still substantially less numerically than it was in 1890 to 1920. But as a proportion of the population, those earlier populations were a much, much higher proportion of the total population. If we look at at the ethnic background of people, and here using country of origin for the foreign-born population and ancestry for the native-born population. Ancestry in Minnesota, the first ancestry, just like it is nationally, is German, but Minnesota diverges a bit for the next few. Secondly, the second largest ancestry group in Minnesota is Norwegian, followed by Irish and Swedish, and then English. But of the current foreign-born population, Mexico ranks first in Minnesota, as it does nationally, followed by Laos, Somalia, India, and Canada. As I mentioned, we've seen a steady increase in the foreign-born population since the early 1970s. If we look at the change in the foreign-born population between those who are still non-citizens and those who are naturalized citizens, much of our increase this decade has been in the naturalized citizens population, but we've seen increases in both the non-citizen and the naturalized citizen population of Minnesota. If we look at the countries of origin or regions of origin in the world for the foreign-born population, we find that Minnesota is really quite different from the rest of the United States.
Mr. Gillespie?
Yes, sir.
Would you prefer questions at the end? Or
I will leave it up to the discretion of the chairs as to whether they would prefer.
Questions would be fine.
Going back to the last slide, if you would.
Sure.
The terminology of the maroon-colored slides of non-citizens includes both permanent residents or otherwise authorized.
That's excuse me, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. The general consensus is that this is the result of a very large survey that the Census Bureau is now conducting, called the American Community Survey. And the general consensus of many demographers is, since the 2000 census, that we have been able to actually include a fairly good count of the total population, both authorized and unauthorized, of the United States. In this case, that 190,700 estimate would presumably include unauthorized as well as authorized residents. But the problem is that we really don't have an independent confirmation of that. And asking that question on a survey is unlikely to result in reliable answers, and so we don't have a real estimate of that. The naturalized citizen, we do have also a counter confirmation in addition to the self-reported counts. We do have another source of information, which is of course the naturalization services.
Thank you, Gallen.
Okay. Mr. Corey?
Yeah. My apologies for being late. I came 1 week early, but I had a meeting that was here. Last week at this time I was here. The question I have is, first, your use of the term unauthorized migrant, is that the standard usage among demographers and statisticians? And the second point tied to that, the slides that you, the numbers that you had earlier, I have the American Community Survey comes up with a number of about 50,000 citizens of Mexican origin. The Pew numbers are ranging from 75 to 100,000. Your own office has an estimate. Could you comment about what could we say as a credible number for Minnesota?
Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Corey, the The estimate of 70, the estimate of 75 to 100,000 unauthorized migrants. Unauthorized is the general term that demographers, as well as I believe that is also the legal term, but I'm not a lawyer, so I would not attempt to make a statement of that effect. But that is the commonly used term that does not equal illegal. That people who are here in an illegal capacity are a portion of a large portion of the unauthorized population, but it is not the complete unauthorized population, and there are certain classes of people that are they are in a process of attaining legal permanent residence. The unauthorized population is anyone who is here who is not a citizen and who is not under who does not have legal permanent residence. So that, for example, a person that is an asylee who is requesting asylum in the United States will be considered unauthorized during the period until their permanent status is determined. On the other hand, refugees who are automatically entered under legal permanent status, but because of a quirk in the way the statistics are calculated, are not included in the immigrant total for a year. It's a processing kind of question. So I don't know if that completely answers your question or not.
The ones on the number, the estimates, the different estimates, and what could be a credible estimate for Minnesota?
The estimate of 75 to 100,000 is based upon the current population survey that the Pew Hispanic Center analyzes. The Pew Center has some very well known, highly reputable demographers, including Jeff Passel, who was with the Census Bureau for a number of years and is considered one of the top experts in the field of making estimates of the unauthorized population. It is always, I believe, a bit of a dicey thing to make an indirect estimate. These are not direct estimates. These are not based upon any determination of people's individual status, but rather backing out of occupation and education levels by citizenship status and making basically a guess as to what proportion of people are unauthorized. And that's one of the reasons for a fairly large range of estimates. 75 to 100,000 represent a reasonable number. My own personal guess would be that may be a little bit the 100,000 may be at the upper, would be, that we would probably tend more towards that lower end than at the upper end, in part because our population is so much different from the rest of the United States, and the difficulty of being an unauthorized resident coming from, for example, Asia or Africa is just simply a physically more difficult thing to do.
Sorry. Anything else? Mr. Kelly.
Just a couple of quick things. I think it's important as the group moves forward. It's especially important around this number, and I don't want to take up too much time, but to peel back the layers of the information, I think it's especially important with Minnesota being a state that accepts a disproportionate number, and maybe you'll cover this, Mr. Gillespie, of refugees. I want to make sure it's understood that refugees do not automatically enter as permanent residents. They enter as refugees, and after 1 year, it is up to them if they want to pursue legal permanent residence. And that could explain some of the counting confusion around whether or not they're included in that unauthorized migrant population. The other additional piece that I would add is there are a number of categories, many of them folks that we help in our office, who would also be included from your description, Mr. Gillespie, persons on temporary protected status, for example. If you remember last fall, there was a lot of publicity around the Liberian community here in Minnesota that's been here for a long time. The estimates are around 1,000 folks in Minnesota on from Liberia on TPS, and those numbers go up for the other countries that have TPS right now, including El Salvador, Honduras, and Somalia. So if you think of Minnesota as a state that has traditionally welcomed a disproportionate number of refugees and also TPS folks, and you're also adding those into the unauthorized migrant, it's a bit confusing.
Yes, Chair, that would be, it is my understanding that people here that are here under temporary protected status are here as unauthorized. And because they're not under legal permanent status, and that they would be included in this unauthorized number. That number includes some people who are here in a clandestine fashion. It includes people who have overstayed visas. It includes people who came here as student workers or students and took a semester off to work during that period. I believe that they would be considered unauthorized. It includes people under temporary protected status and asylees. It does not include refugees. Although refugees do not, as you point out, come under legal permanent status, that is not granted until a year later, but because of the unusual way in which refugees come here is sort of pre-authorized rather than post-authorized, they are considered not in the unauthorized population. It's not a simple, I think people have a vision of this being a very simple number, and it is not a simple number. It includes very different people from very different circumstances.
Mr. Keller?
Thank you for that. One way that perhaps the number has, or the terminology, and we could look at this, has evolved is perhaps it's counting people if sort of the standard to get you out of that category is legal permanent residence, anyone who is here in a non-immigrant status, including people here currently within the terms of their visa, in a non-immigrant visa, perhaps would be included in that number. So students, religious workers, and certainly other, even tourists, you would think would not be on the track towards, under the terminology of the demographers, a permanent status. Would they also, in your estimation, be included here? Not just people who've overstayed their visas, but those who are actually here and inside the terms of their visa.
Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Kelleher, is my understanding that people are here under specific visa categories are not included under the unauthorized migrant population.
Mr. Gillespie, to help clarify this, do you think you can provide us with the information as far as who falls underneath the unauthorized and bring that back to the group? Would that be all right?
Chair, yes.
Thank you.
And Minnesota's population is substantially different from foreign-born population, substantially different from the national population. The biggest difference is that over half of all foreign-born people in the United States are from Latin America, but in Minnesota that comprises less than 30% of the total, with Asia providing a larger proportion in Minnesota, and Minnesota also has an immigration from Africa that is much lower than it is in the national population. If we look at the history since the early 80s of immigration, we get a sense of some of the ebb and flow of the change in the early and mid 80s up until the mid 90s. The immigration specifically from Laos was fairly substantial. That is the darker blue section at the top. That diminished some in the latter part of the 90s, but the immigration from India and China began to pick up. But overall, immigration from Asia represented a smaller portion as we move forward in time. The immigration from Mexico was fairly small in during the 80s and began to increase into the 90s, and it has been a fairly consistent number throughout the 90s and into today. The immigration from Russia and former Soviet Union countries to a large extent followed the breakup of the Soviet Union and was fairly substantial during much of the 90s. It has diminished but continues to this day. And then the immigration from Africa, particularly from Somalia and from Ethiopia, really began to emerge in the mid-90s and is now the most frequent source of direct immigrants to Minnesota. So if we look at the top five sources of immigrants to Minnesota, these are people moving to Minnesota in 2006. Somalia was first, followed by Thailand. But Thailand, in this case, represented really people who were Laotian, who were Hmong people, who had been in a camp for some time in Thailand. When that camp was closed, they came to the United States under refugee status, and so Thailand represented our second source, followed by Ethiopia, then Mexico, and then Liberia as direct immigrants to Minnesota. That's really quite different from the national population, where Mexico was substantially the largest population, followed by China, the Philippines, India, and Cuba. So another way, also another piece of information that we have on new cultures and new peoples moving to Minnesota is to look at the language spoken at home by children in school. We don't have information in
Mr.
this
Chair.
Case.
Oh, excuse me, Mr. Gillespie. Mr. Keller.
I apologize. I have one other question on the last slide.
That's fine.
Mr. Gillespie, on the last slide. Top five sources of 2006 immigrants. My guess is that this slide represents people that would be tracked by USCIS. Is that accurate?
Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Keller, yes, this is actually data from the State Department of Homeland Security, which used to be the Immigration Service, and the Immigration Service is now part of Homeland Security.
Mr. Keller?
Thank you.
Any other questions? Right. Mr. Gillespie, please.
Chair, if we look at the number of children who speak a language other than English at home, and many of these children may have been born in the United States, but in terms of culture and language, we find is a fairly steady increase in Minnesota over the past decade and a half to now approximately 11% of our children in K-12 public education spoke a language other than English at home. That is still substantially less than the nation. Again, the nation is in 2003 was close to 19%. There are substantial differences around the state by school district, with St. Paul with the largest proportion of students speaking a language other than English at home at 43%. The second highest proportion of students speaking a non-English language was in Worthington School District with over 37%, followed very closely by Richfield and Brooklyn Center. Richfield and Brooklyn Center have just recently emerged on this list as the third and fourth highest proportions. And you will note that this includes both areas that are central city, suburban, as well as greater Minnesota places that are oftentimes related to specific employers and specific employment opportunities in greater Minnesota. The 10 most commonly spoken languages in non-English schools, again, reflects very similar kinds of populations with that the foreign-born and immigrant population represents, with Spanish being the most common language, followed by Hmong and Somali. But as you can see, the languages spoken include a wide variety from all over the world, and at most recent count from last year, there were more than 90 different languages spoken in Minnesota schools. Now, one question is why are we changing? And most of the analysis points to really four areas. One is the demand for specially skilled workers. Second is the demand for workers in lower wage jobs. Third is refugee movements. And fourth is family reunifications as a major source. If we look at major groupings of admissions for new legal permanent residents, one of the places that Minnesota is really quite different from the rest of the country is in terms of the proportion of admissions who are here as refugee or asylee. For most of this is primarily a refugee population. Minnesota consistently has one of the largest refugee immigrations in the nation, usually a number close to the number in California, but as a proportion of the population, a substantially higher proportion than any other state. And in Minnesota, approximately a quarter of our admissions for legal permanent residents to Minnesota are here on refugee status, and the countries of origin really vary from period to period, and it's almost a truism to say that if you see something big happening in the world, it's probably going to have some impact on Minnesota's population in the future. Initially there were strong movements of people from Southeast Asia, but we've also seen people from the Soviet Union and former Soviet countries. We've seen people from former Yugoslavian countries and from Africa and more recently from Burma, with the Karen population moving to Minnesota as under refugee status. Employment and employment related and family members who move with workers remains one of the largest sources of immigration to the United States and is important also for Minnesota. And here the people that move long distances and cross significant boundaries tend to be a much younger population, and not surprisingly, we find that if we look at Minnesota's workforce, a much higher proportion of our workforce in younger ages is foreign-born, and a much smaller proportion of our older workers were born in another country. And education levels really cover all levels of education that move to Minnesota, with really almost a bimodal distribution, with representing with education levels of less than a high school diploma representing substantial portions of the workforce, but also people with advanced degrees representing substantial proportions. In 2006, 12% of Minnesota's workforce with an advanced degree, bachelor's degree or higher, 12% was foreign-born. And of Minnesota's workforce with less than a high school diploma, 22% was foreign-born.
Mr. Gillespie?
Yes, sir.
Do you have, on that slide there, do you have a breakout of the individuals that are authorized and unauthorized in each one of those degrees?
Mr. Chair, members of the study group, no, we do not have that information. We don't have separate direct confirmation of status of unauthorized. Those are all indirect estimates, and we would have no real way to to determine this. The Pew Center would, for Hispanic, Pew Hispanic Center would tend to focus on people with less than a high school diploma as being a likely source of unauthorized residents, but that suffers a bit from the lack of confirmation evidence, and we wouldn't have that information for Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Gillespie. And the reason I bring that up, we're going to get to know each other a little bit better as we move forward. And so with my questions and my comments, I don't want to upset people. However, I think you'll know where I'm going with this eventually. One of my concerns and one of the areas that I continue to point out is you do not hear of people risking their lives to come to the United States to be a computer programmer or to be a doctor or to be a professor. It is people that do jobs like I do in agriculture or others. And so I just want to build off of that as we move forward. All right?
And Mr. Chair, and I think this will help confirm your previous statement.
Mr. Gillespie, we have one other question.
Oh, yes.
First question, just to comment that you'll probably be able to dice the data by citizen and non-citizen.
Okay.
And you'll somewhat get the same pattern that in terms of the bimodal distribution of education degrees and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gillespie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we look at the industries with the greatest concentrations of foreign-born workers, these are the industries where a substantial portion of all workers were born in another country. And this is by rank order. The top two are food processing, food and vegetable processing, and animal slaughtering and processing. Are the top two, followed by professional services to building and dwellings. That is largely janitorial services to buildings and dwellings, followed by retail for specialty foods. And then we jump into a very different group of manufacturing and medical equipment and supplies, and navigation, electrical, medical, and control instruments are generally fairly high-skilled, high-tech industries. And so we see a substantial portion of foreign-born people in both relatively lower-wage, lower-skilled industries as well as very high-tech, high-skilled skilled industries. And if we look at divide the foreign-born population up, the employed foreign-born population by industry of occupation, restaurant and food service accounts for 10% of the foreign-born population, but colleges and universities account for 5%, hospitals 4%, construction 4%, and medical equipment is 3%. Animal slaughtering and processing accounts for 2% of the foreign-born population moving to living in Minnesota. And just a few additional things, a few characteristics here. One is, and looking at the foreign-born population in general, again, not surprisingly, because it's younger people who tend to cross significant boundaries and move long distances. The foreign-born population is heavily concentrated in Minnesota in the 25 to 44-year-old age group, while the native-born population tends to be somewhat older than the foreign-born population. We also see concentrations in education levels with substantial portions of people with less than a high school diploma, but also substantial portions of people with a bachelor's degree or a graduate or professional degree. And one other element is important for government operations as well as many businesses is the ability to speak English for people who speak a language other than English at home. And of the foreign-born population, a quarter of the foreign-born population speaks only English, that they do not speak a non-English language at home, and another 34% speak English very well, and another 19% well. Only about 5% speak a language other than English, and speak English not at all. There is relatively little research, but there is some research on whether or not current populations of foreign-born people are learning English at the same rate as people who immigrated here 100 years ago, and most of the evidence is pointing to there being essentially no difference in the rate at which people learn English between now and previous waves of people from other countries.
And Madam Chair, a question.
Mr.
Gillespie, do you have the source for that study, and could you make it available to the working group?
I can certainly make that
thank you.
Source available. And with that, Madam Chair, I conclude my remarks. If there are additional questions, I can certainly stand for.
Before we proceed with questions, we didn't give the time to two members who were not here at the beginning of the meeting to introduce themselves, and I would like to ask you to please introduce yourselves and tell us who you represent and who appointed you.
Well, I guess I'm not certain who appointed me. Well, I can tell you who I am. Yes. My name is Gloria Contreras Eden. I'm the executive director for Centro Legal. Centro Legal is a nonprofit law firm. We've been around for 26 years, and I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you.
I'm Bruce Corey. I'm an economist, a professor at Concordia University. Follow some of these issues a little closer.
Thank you. Thank you. Any questions from committee members?
Mr. Corey. I just wanted to take this opportunity to commend the State Demographer's Office and Mr. Gillespie for providing some, throughout these years, some very objective demographic numbers of Minnesota, and as a resource we commonly rely on to ask some of the difficult questions. Some of the things I might have to ask might not be, he might not be able to do it today, but maybe in a future meeting I'd like to see some of that information. First, on the area of, you made a point about the demand for foreign-born workers or what is driving increased immigration to Minnesota. And you talked about demand for specially skilled workers and demand for workers in lower-wage jobs. I'm wondering if we could reach some kind of estimate or measure of this demand and whether is there some way to quantify. For example, Deed on their website has a new tool called Occupations in Demand, where you could rank many of these occupations appoint in different regions of Minnesota. But I think it's a very important part for the conversation to get a better handle on demand. Demand for specially skilled workers, I just looked at the applications for high H-1B visas in Minnesota, and I found over 100 cities in Minnesota were asking for these workers. So the more we get a sense of demand, I think the conversation in the state could be better. I know that you've done, Mr. Gillespie, a lot of good work on population projections. I've just used some of your data to make projections, but I would maybe request him to do that. While talking about this age group of workers, you've used a term in the past, and I've got it from somewhere, I think around from your office, in projection the workers to 2030, in that prime age group that you might classify prime workers, say 25 to 54, and the prime tax base from 25 to 54. And there's a particular group that I've taken, and I've seen that the in the 20 to 30, from 2005 to 2030, large increases are going to occur in the prime workers and the prime tax base, Asian and Latino populations. Some of that kind of information might be available for us, these population projections, tying to workforce needs would be very critical to our conversations.
Mr. Sadowski, do you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair, for Mr. Gillespie. In the breakout of advanced degrees, bachelor's degrees, et cetera, for the foreign-born, is there a subset of that that can tell us how many of those people came to the country with those degrees versus acquired that education here. It kind of comes to Representative Hamilton's question a little bit.
Chair, Mr. Sandusky, that's an excellent question, and I don't have an answer for that. There is a class of emergency legal permanent status for people who have graduated, particularly from medical school, who are foreign-born workers who agree to serve in underserved areas and are given a fast track to do that. And so for example, in some parts of western Minnesota and Dakotas and some of the other areas in the prairie where populations are now very old and declining, the local doctor is somebody from another country, and because they, you know, they there is no other doctor, and so that represents a critical demand. Now the number is going to be so small that it's not going to show up in national statistics, but the critical nature of that is fairly substantial, and you know that's really the only source of health care that many people have. There are also other areas similar to health care, and particularly nursing. We have a chronic nursing shortage, and much of the immigration, for example, from the Philippines has been historically related to nurses. I understand that the Philippine government is not particularly happy about that, but Minnesota and the United States is taking advantage of highly skilled and highly trained people moving here to fill critically short occupations. And so there is that kind of evidence, but we would have to go to the to academic records as to and follow-up studies as to we have no independent information on whether or not people graduated from higher education in the United States. So we'd have to go to follow-up studies. And let me see if I can find anything on.
Madam Chair, this ties into Mr. Corey's comments also. This past Wednesday, Mr. Gillespie put on an excellent presentation for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce event that basically covered a lot of your questions with regards to demographics and the change and the workforce change in Minnesota and how it's going to very much change the face of many different types of jobs, from high skill to labor, et cetera. And it was quite concerning to myself as well as others that change is coming, and it's happening quicker than we've known about it for a lot of years, but it's coming. And that report would be, I think, be helpful to this committee. It helps put it in perspective, because that's what we're looking at, is the future in our workforce, et cetera. And we're in a tight scheme right now, and it's going to get tighter. And so that would be very helpful, I think, to help frame this up.
Thank you. An issue that is of question to me, because the mandate that we have is so broad, I want to make sure that after this presentation we engage in the conversation as to how do we define our plan. Obviously, there is an opportunity that we have to define that right now is quite broad. And I want to make sure that we stay really true to the mandate. And I want you to review that. You have a document in your package that is the Legislative Commission resolution. And in that particular document, in number 4, it articulates the duties, and it basically says to undertake activities it determines necessary to assist the state government to foster an understanding and appreciation of ethnic and cultural diversity in Minnesota, which is really a broad statement. So I want to make sure that we don't narrow the scope of this mandate to really into kind of some of the challenges that we deal with in terms of one ethnic group versus the other, one challenge versus the other, and look at kind of a broader perspective. So it's a challenge to us. I don't know how we do that, but it's something that I want us to really think about from the very beginning so that we don't put ourselves in a situation where we narrow the focus so much that then we're not going to be able to explore other opportunities that certainly we could undertake because this is an open opportunity to all of us. Unless you have more questions for Mr. Gillespie, I would like to, please, Mr. Curry.
I can talk later. I'm done.
Okay. Thank you so much for your presentation.
Thank you.
And in this particular document, it also says that we could convene a working committee, so I very much hope that we can count on you to help us in this process of figuring out, you know, how do we get information and answers to some of the questions these members may have.
Yes.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
With that, one thing that we could also try to do for the, I think, the beginning of this work that is ahead of us is try to figure out what kind of information do we need? What state agencies, groups do we need to invite? We have a representative from the American Indian community, John Poupard. I see his name. He's not here today, but we are also obviously need to include, when we talk about heritage, a conversation about the American Indian population. So any comments, any questions from members of the group as to how do we, we're going to get into the second part of our agenda, which is to have this discussion on defining the scope of our work. What kind of information do we need to have? Do we define the goals for this group and then try to figure out how do we obtain information that can help us get our work done? Do we do the other way around? Do we find information, trying to learn as much as we can, and then define? We have flexibility to do so. So I would like to hear from all of you. I'd like to give, we have about 50 minutes to do both, to hear from all of you and also to start framing this the work plan for this group. Mr. Curry.
While you were speaking about the task of the agenda of the commission, I just would share you some of my work that might show the range of where this commission could go. When I look at immigrant, minority, Native American groups in Minnesota and the nation, I look at them in these categories as consumers, called consumer capital. I look at them as workers, productive human capital. I look at them as entrepreneurs, that is entrepreneurial capital. I look at them in terms of fiscal capital, contributed as taxpayers. I look at them as global networks because they connect us in trade and our global world. And then I look at them as cultural capital, adding cultural assets to the state. That's a very broad range that can bring in the multi-dimensions of where the people enter this state and play a role. So there could be a way to visualize this broad dimensions of the contributions. Also, I was very happy to read the paper today that the legislature has agreed on that tax that might come up, that 19% goes to heritage and preservation of heritage. So it's good news that they have come up with some good ideas.
Let's remember that that vote was only to ask the public to vote on it.
Uh-huh.
So it's not done. This is, which is passable, to ask the public to make that decision, and it's up to the public to make that decision. So
Madam
yes.
Chair, I noticed in the scope statement that we talk about social, cultural, and political life in the state. We're looking for full participation. And I'm wondering, is economic left out by accident, or is that included in the terminology? Because to Mr. Corey's point, most of the points he raised are economic issues, and they're of critical importance to the state. But they're of critical importance to, I think, immigrants being assimilated into our state in a appropriate manner, if you will. Or
absolutely. And I assume that within the social context, we will be talking about economic.
Okay.
This is not really limiting. At least this is my interpretation. We really have an opportunity to obviously talk about all issues within the social, cultural, and political life of the state, and that will definitely include economic, which is something that we definitely need to talk about. And most of you have asked questions related to the economic impact and labor and education, which are all closely related. Yes.
One of the interesting parts of the duties that we have here that really attracted my attention from the very start and was the ability or the charge that we assist the government as well as the people of the state of Minnesota to understand and appreciate the ethnic diversity and the contributions of the immigrant community. I think it really is a first step to having an appreciation. And what I'm looking forward to and my expectation in one of the discussion points was what are your expectations, is how can we make people better aware of those contributions. And I think it's a critical point that we must make in order to assimilate the immigrant population into our communities. And anything that we can do to move that forward and spur that on is going to be critical, I believe. That's one of my expectations from this group.
Madam Chair, I agree with Senator Gimsey. I think one of the reasons that attracted me and in representing our type of business, which is an outstate Minnesota, rural Minnesota, is to bring facts through a thoughtful discussion and debate versus the emotional rhetoric that you hear.
Right.
And I think that's something this commission can bring forward, is bring the right people in with the right information, factual information, and we can appropriately dispel some of this rhetoric taking place. Because as we look at workforce development, and we're very concerned about that as a company and our future needs, we're in a tight supply right now, whether that be for trying to find engineers, accountants, to people to work in our processing facilities. And it's a tight market, and it's going to get worse. And so we're very concerned about that. Where are we going to find the people to keep our business and the economy going? So where's that human capital going to come from in the future? And I think by helping this commission bringing together a good discussion and bringing those information together and how this is all linked together with the economy and the human capital, et cetera, I think we can do some real good to get the right information out rather than people depending on sound bites coming out, which far too often frame the discussion.
So such an exciting opportunity, and I couldn't agree more. Part of the challenge for us is that as we tend to speculate about the negative things, we also speculate about what we have. And so some of the information is available, is my understanding, but some of it is not. And so we're going to have to be very creative and also very diligent about figuring out ways through which we can submit recommendations that to the legislature to collect that information, because unfortunately it is my understanding that in many areas we just simply do not have that information. And so let me then ask the question to the group. Is it the view of the group that we should begin to compile some information about different aspects related to human capital, as you define it, and the different contributions, starting with what we were already given in terms of kind of factual information, numbers, and then moving into perhaps asking our staff to help us and you in the community to help us put together information that will give us some kind of a framework with respect to different areas, defining that those areas in terms of contributions. And we will have to define those areas ourselves. Basically said, you know, these are issues, information that we should have available to us. Is that a good beginning? Is that something that we should pursue collectively? Give me examples of information. It seems that very definitely labor-related questions are questions that you want to have some sort of information. Yes, Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things that struck me when I visited Century College, which is serves about 700 of my constituents in White Bear Lake, is that they do seem to be very in tune with the business community because they're churning out folks into the labor force, particularly for very specialized topics. And I was interested to see that they have done some of the research where they could be able to tell us what they are hearing from businesses in different sectors. And since Minsky campuses are spread out all over the state, they focus everything from agriculture to industrial development to high tech to, at least in our case, focusing on dentistry and prosthetics and a whole variety of other things where we're told that they can't get enough people. So I would think that either through the higher education committees in the House and Senate or through Minsky directly, we could get an idea of what they're hearing and what they're doing to prepare folks for. And I'm suspecting that we will find out that there is still a disconnect between needs and the actual number of people available to do it. The other thing that I would hope we'd hear from, and we don't necessarily have to have a presentation about it, but just from the Minnesota Historical Society, I'm the vice chair of the Heritage Finance Committee in the House, and we oversee their program. But we've been through some of these issues before, not exactly the same, because we're facing an increasing number of retirees with the baby boomers retiring and a flat labor force, unlike we had, say, in that 1890 to 1920 period that Mr. Gillespie talked about. But we've been through some of the issues of reconciling views of each other and other people, and whether how did we somehow come together to solve that. And people joke about it now, but Swedes and Germans didn't get together in lots of rural communities, as I found out on my wife's family, and somehow they figured it all out. So I guess I'd like to see where we've been. We shouldn't reinvent the wheel on how communities have come together and come together as Minnesotans. So I'd be interested in some polling data, too. I mean, we're 10 people in a room, but if we produce a report that just goes on the shelf without finding out what the public is really sensing, whether we agree with it or not, and figure out how to maybe bridge the gap between the facts that we know to be true about our labor needs and so on and what people are really thinking, I think that would be helpful for us to figure out how we can bridge that gap in some public fashion later.
Very, very, very good. I would like to ask our staff to please help us dig out a document that I read several years ago now. And it's called Turn of the Century. It was put together by Minnesota Planning. And Turn of the Century has quotes and some information that was quite revealing. I see our state demographer smiling about it because it's interesting when we read that particular document, at least when I read the document, it was almost like we could put that document today. And pretend that we're talking about replace the words German and Scandinavian and put Latino and Somali, and it will read exactly the same way. And so I would like us to have that document. I would also like to bring to you, next time I still have my book from my social work 101 when I was getting in the School of Social Work to get my master's, which I didn't get because I went into public policy. But the quotes in one of the books that train social workers about how we came up with child welfare policies are almost exactly the same, and I'd like to bring that next time, which really illustrates some of the comments that you make, Representative Gardner, with respect to understanding where we have been, where we are now, and how do we get through this with a clear understanding of how to respond to the public's perceptions and needs. Is it appropriate to think that we should form committees to deal with these different aspects? Because it seems to me that it's going to be very difficult for this whole group to take on, you know, all of these areas. But I believe that based on what I see from our members, that it will be absolutely really to the advantage of this group to form a business group, a business subcommittee that could help us frame this particular approach in terms of how do we ask the questions, who do we ask the questions, because as you stated, we already have some information, Representative Gardner, that local communities have been able to put together. And the Chamber of Commerce, I'm sure, will have that information. And people who are currently employing different immigrant members will have that information available to us. And so is it, you think, appropriate to have a subcommittee that will look into that? And I would like to ask who wants to volunteer to be in that particular committee to look at the business perspective in terms of workforce development, contributions, business development, and issues related to that.
I'd certainly like to.
You would like to be?
Committee, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I will volunteer for that also.
Okay, wonderful.
Madam Chair, I would also.
Okay. So, Mr. Corey, so I would put a...
In terms of the charge of this commission on ethnic heritage, a way to bring in the broader groups that go beyond immigrants, the Native American communities, is to also begin this discussion on cultural capital and cultural heritage. And again, do a committee that would try to assess our cultural capital in Minnesota, what are the different things that are happening out there? For example, I'm part of a group that has proposed that in this area around University Avenue, we create a World Cultural Heritage District. That would be a nodal point to connect to culture all over the world and all over Minnesota. And in that process of that experience, I realized that that's the glue that brings different people to the table, too, who might feel excluded from an agenda that might be focused. So maybe a committee on cultural capital to that, cultural heritage that might.
Absolutely. There is a close connection here, I think, that has been clearly defined by many people in the state and outside of this state in terms of how culturally children who speak multiple languages, children who are exposed to a multicultural environment, are much more able to get the education that they need to compete in a global economy. And so that, you know, we are at a disadvantage when we don't speak another language. We are at a disadvantage when we, attend schools that don't give us these opportunities to interact with people that are multicultural, that represent that global social context that we need today in business. So I am very interested in this particular cultural heritage subcommittee. Anybody else that would like to participate in that committee? Again, this, you know, this committee is will be able to form working committees that we can work with. So the subcommittee that we just formed could elect, you know, a co-chairs and then invite members of the community to participate with you and create a larger working committee that could work with you in designing and planning your work. anybody else that is interested in a cultural heritage subcommittee group? Okay.
Representative Gardner. Can I have a comment? I'm not sure why Mr. Pupart is not here. Mm-hmm. But I know there's a lot of very interesting things happening in the American Indian community around cultural heritage up in northern Minnesota and in other areas, and I think we could, through his explore his involvement in that.
So we're going to appoint Mr. Cooper.
That's what happens when you don't come.
Committee. We will let him
I have
know.
A comment about the scope, if you will.
Yes,
there are lots of questions, and all of them have been excellent. I think the temptation and the expectation has been very affirming to hear that I think a lot of us, perhaps all of us, are here for the same reasons, which is to further the education, not only of ourselves, of course, but I think of the greater Minnesota community. In a time, as Joe mentioned, when there is a almost complete absence of education in that vein. Some of the practical questions that I have include looking very clearly at the termination of this working group. The date is now less than a year away. The elected officials here, I assume, have a full agenda for the next couple months. And so I think defining the scope of what's possible, of what's real, and what are our immediate priorities, including, of course, those of us who aren't elected officials, I think we also have full agendas. My hope would be that as we move forward, and I think in some of the testimony that I heard around this commission that Representative Hamilton and Senator Mimua brought forward as it was being discussed last year, was really to propose a group where the politics that so commonly infuse conversations about immigrants and immigration could be checked at the door, and we can talk about the real facts and the real needs from all of the different perspectives out there and get at some of the hard truths. I think we have a real opportunity, from my perspective, and also listening to folks today, to serve that function, or at least to begin to set up a structure or a greater, longer-standing committee where that can be done. And I look to and encourage the other members of the working group to look to Illinois as an example. Illinois, since 2005, has a Office of New Americans, and it has created a structure with multiple levels of education and specialties, specifically to send the message both to those who don't regularly interact with immigrants, the mainstream community, and to the immigrant community, that Illinois is a place that welcomes immigrants. And it goes through policy, it goes through the workforce challenges that Illinois is facing, and all of them are very similar to what Minnesota is facing. I would look to that and encourage folks to look to that as where we're striving to. The other practical question is, who's going to be doing the work that comes out of all of the good ideas here? I believe that there's no budget, or perhaps only a cost budget, associated with this commission, and it's a conversation that we would have to have in terms of if we don't ourselves possess the knowledge that we need or the data we need, who are we going to turn to and on what schedule and what timetable, especially if we have an end date 11 months away for this commission. In terms of prioritizing from where I sit, would propose that one of the immediate priorities be, especially as the session is undertaken, and if you don't know, several immigration-related pieces of legislation have already been dropped in the hopper. We, as this commission, have the opportunity to also look at those, find folks who can comment on the pros and cons of them, and be a resource to the many legislators with good intentions who want to try to find a solution for the state of Minnesota with state-based immigration policy. From my perspective, of course, as an immigration professional, we know that all immigration policy that that truly affects status happens at the federal level. So we're really trying to fill a hole, and legislators who are proposing legislation are trying to fill a hole because the federal government isn't acting on these issues. But in terms of priority, I would say for all of the energy that I am aware of to try to address immigration at the state level, I would propose that this committee in the immediate short term during session be a place where we can serve to help vet and provide information on some of those pieces of legislation sort of before they have consequences that perhaps weren't intended.
I would very much appreciate feedback on that, because I think part of what we need to define as a group is really the scope. And I think that Mr. Keller brings some very, very important points. He mentions the need to establish kind of an institutional type of effort and an office that assumes responsibility for information, tracking information, providing information, not just to the new immigrant community, but to the community as a whole. The second one he addresses is the need to really look at the impact of legislation that is currently being proposed. So if we look at immigrant population, and these particular legislative proposals are aimed at resolving or proposing specific strategies to address, you know, immigration, do we take a look at that? And then the issue of how do we create a coalition to push the immigration reform that so many need and that so many advocate for, so that we can resolve some of these labor issues and issues related to economic development. So those are issues that, you know, I personally want this group to define, because Senator Gimsey is here, who is authoring some of this legislation that the governor proposed, and he could share with you kind of the summary. I'm glad you're back, Senator Gimsey, because we're talking about legislation now. So it's up to you to make the decision. It's up to us to make the decision and to balance that those two. So I would like to hear from all of you.
Well, Madam Chair, you know, just to address what Mr. Keller was saying, myself and Representative Yaros were having a friendly conversation about immigration. And how this all, what this stemmed from was, he was talking about his life and coming to the United States, et cetera. And I was sharing the story as far as my family, my great-grandfather coming over here, and he was undocumented, came over here from Germany during World War I. He spoke German. He had a very difficult time here. My grandfather spoke German. My mother, when she was a little child during World War II, spoke German and had a very difficult time. Who are we fighting during World War I and II? It was the Germans. And they had a very difficult time. And so my question was, and then fast forward to the early 70s, I live in Mountain Lake, Minnesota, which is a Russian Mennonite community. And it was the churches that went to Laos and were bringing families back to Mountain Lake. And you take a look, and I have good friends there as well, you know, basically came over from Laos. I have a very good friend who is a U.S. citizen. His three children are U.S. citizens. His wife came over here legally, per se. However, they mixed up some numbers when she came through immigration. She's been battling for 7 years to try to get the status. You take a look at the first generation that came over here, they had a difficult time. The second generation are now business owners. They have the Laotian grocery store. They have one of the stores is King Egg Roll, you know, and they serve certain individuals. The third generation are the ones that are sitting on my couch now playing video games with my son and my daughter, or playing basketball outside, or scholars, homecoming kings and queens, etc. And I was, the question that I had with Mr. Yaros and others, Representative Yaros, is how can we speed that process up? Yeah, is it possible to speed that process up. The other thing is one of the cities that I represent is second on the list for students speaking non-English languages at home, and I also have I have two on there. Going back to the businesses, another concern that I had in our chamber back in the city of Worthington, the Latino businesses in Worthington, none of them were a part of the chamber. And I asked the question, why not? And there was just a gap there that neither side was asking the questions or trying to bridge that gap to bring the, you know, all the business together to see the benefit of being a part of the chamber. And so these were all questions that I was raising along with the employment side of things, understanding the true need from employers throughout the state. So these were the conversations, the simple, the basic conversations that we were having, a whole lot of questions out there. And then the next question was, how do we answer this? How do we address this? We bring in the experts. We've identified the problem. Now, who can we bring to the table to start working towards the answers and the solutions to these issues? It's huge. Obviously, it's huge. But again, that was the whole conversation with myself and Representative Yaros. And I know we're short on time here, but what we were saying was it's not just, and please, I'm just speaking freely here, it's not just an issue with Latinos. It's not just an issue with Native Americans. And like Representative Yaros said, he was talking about concentration camps with his family and everything else. He said it should be about all the groups, and I agree. And so that's why that was our intent on why bringing this together. And again, that's just identifying the issues. How can we work together to move forward? You asked about the policy side of things. You know, I personally think, whether it's in here or not, I think we need to have the pros and the cons about policy that's coming forth, because we're making decisions, like you said, on emotional basis, not necessarily the facts of the issue. We're making decisions based on emotions. And so we need to have the facts out there when it comes, and I can get into those. I'll do that at the next meeting. But that's where this group can gather the information, can provide that back to legislators, the pros, the cons, and stuff like that, so that we can make educated decisions on policy. That would be on the policy side, the political side. And on the cultural side and the social side, it'd be like the chambers. How can we give direction to the chambers to reach out to the new businesses that are in town, and how can we inform those new businesses how they would be benefiting from being in the chamber? I rattle. I understand
no, this
that.
Is, this is but exactly where...
Those were the conversations that we were having, and that's where my friend over here, he and I were talking about. These were conversations that he and I were having 3 years ago, scratching on the board in my office on how we can form a group to address these very issues. And it doesn't matter if you come from Germany or from Ethiopia or wherever. It doesn't matter where you come from. We're all in this together. That was the gist of the conversation. That's why I feel we're here. Mm-hmm. Now, take it away.
So the question, I think that Representative Hamilton really speaks to what all of us really are about, which is coming together to figure out, you know, how do we address this issue. So the question of how do we incorporate some kind of a strategy within our working plan to look at policy proposals, because ultimately that's what we do here. Ultimately what we will do is provide recommendations to pursue policy, to appoint a committee. Ultimately that's what you're doing here. So I assume it's pertinent to say that that we should take a look at kind of the policy reviews and collecting information so that we can become a committee that provides, you know, factual information to policymakers that intend to pursue, you know, policies impacting immigrant communities. Is that, do we form a committee on that? Well, yes, Senator.
Madam Chair, I guess I would like to express a concern that I guess I would have with this committee moving in that particular direction, because, you know, we had a nice, very nice 45-minute talk in your office the other day. There are interest groups on both sides of this issue, and, you know, when it comes to policy and legislation, we feel the pressure from both the extremes on both sides. Do we want to mire ourselves in that discussion in, as far as this group goes?
Madam Chair?
Representative
Hammond. Senator, I think where this group needs to stay focused is what Mr. Keller was saying. We can weigh out the pros and the cons of policy that's coming forth. I don't think we should take, well, I personally don't think we should take a strong position on it. We weigh out the pros and the cons of it, you know. Just supply the legislators, that's the political piece. We had basically three directions, the social, the cultural, and the political, right? Mm-hmm. We've identified the group, I think, on the social or the business group, right? Mm-hmm. That all is encompassed there. Mm-hmm. And on the political side, we can identify a group to take that portion also, to not take a position per se, but to weigh out the pros and the cons, provide the facts to make these decisions, to base the decisions on. And then the legislators can make up their mind after that. Am I accurate there?
Yes, and if I may, Mr. Representative. I'd also like to say that although there are two sides to the issues and there are sort of very polarized positions on this issue particularly, there is something that I have noticed, at least across my travels throughout Minnesota. I've noticed that we all have shared values, and we have shared values around the economy, around how we treat one another socially, and how we want our communities to look like. We all want healthy, positive, strong communities. And so I think if we can keep the conversation at that level and focus on our shared values, I think Mr. Keller's points about bringing in the pros and cons would be quite beneficial on the proposed legislative or proposed legislation. I wonder if in that conversation we also wouldn't have a conversation about the recent executive orders and particularly the economic fallout of those orders and how they will play out in workforce development because they do primarily affect businesses, consequently affect communities. And so I don't know if that's part of the conversation, whether we can introduce some of that conversation about the pros and cons. Again, keeping it at that level, the values level, is that a possibility?
Again, Senator Gimsey, remember, you determine the scope of this, the work of this group. It is clear to me that, you know, what we need to maintain is what you articulated, Mr. Keller, which is we're really creating kind of the foundation that will provide information, will provide, you know, opportunities for people in different groups in the community to give that information. How we, I think Representative Hamilton is correct to say that how we take this is really up to us. So Representative Hamilton and Representative Gardner, Senator Gimsey and I may take it in completely opposite directions, and we will deal with that and deal with our communities, our districts, the districts that we represent, and the entire state as a whole. But this group, it really is a thing has been appointed to provide really more of an opportunity to look at these issues within that context of factual information, support from the community. What do we have, what we don't have, that we really need to incorporate into the work that we do legislatively? Senator Gimsey.
And I appreciate the conversation that we've had. Don't get me wrong. You know, I want us to have an open and honest and frank discussion completely across the board based on facts, leaving emotions and preconceived notions at the door. But, you know, the working group or the subcommittee on jobs and the impact that the immigrant community certainly has on the state of Minnesota and the workforce and our businesses, I believe is a terrific opportunity for us. You know, it seems to me in here that what we are charged to do is to highlight, not just understand, but highlight those types of things, inform people of, you know, basically what would we do without the immigrant community in certain areas, you know, how are they contributing? And on the cultural side, we can effectively do the same thing, you know, bringing in organizations like the Chicano Latino Affairs Council, different organizations like that that can really highlight and help Minnesotans and the legislature understand the contributions that the immigrant population is making in Minnesota. And the way I see this, our charge under this organization is to spread that word, engage the legislature in helping us help Minnesotans understand it and appreciate better the contributions of the immigrant community in this state, rather than, and I'll say it again, mire ourselves potentially in legislation, because, you know, I'm going to be pursuing some legislation that, you know, it is going to look into and try to resolve some of the criminal aspects that we're seeing out there. You know, the document fraud, the identity theft, you know, and how that's affecting, you know, trying to stop the effects of that, you know, in our business community and in our government services areas. And I don't want to, I think it will take away from the good work that we could possibly accomplish here in informing the state of Minnesota and legislators about the good things that are happening. I guess I see a different focus for this group based on the charge that I read than to sit and talk about legislation and where you're coming. It's so easy to bring preconceived notions to the table if we start to do that. That's my concern.
Representative Hamilton, Mr. Curry, and Ms. Contreras.
I'll wait.
Okay. Ms. Contreras, Mr. Curry. No. Mr. Curry, go ahead, and then Ms. Contreras.
Okay. I just want to follow up from Senator Gimsey and Representative Gardner about public attitudes. Looking through the research, some of the more current research in economics about this whole issue comes to an interesting conclusion from a researcher in California, who I consider the leading person on this debate, that the groups that have the most attitudes against immigrants tend to be the ones that are benefiting most from it, like probably the high school graduate, some college graduate education. And in these polls that you talk about, what people's attitudes about this, I'm not sure whether they understand that benefit they're getting from the groups that they're having the attitude. So maybe a sense of what are the attitudes out here that we can address. And it was behind some of my questions to Mr. Gillespie, because again, I see the national data reflected here that immigrants being complementary to native workers at the different levels from high school and low school, the demand kinds of issues that I was asking. I see some things where it could serve to educate. I really like the comments that made that our committees could be a way in which we educate people, Minnesota, as we go on through these subcommittees. And that's also behind the point that John raised and the question I asked Mr. Gillespie about the word unauthorized migrant. That's the kind of issue that we want to bring clarity. We can bring clarity in the debate. When we talk about an issue, who are we talking about? And right now, I see people talking about so many things. Just the complexity that John brought out in that term, I think 90% of Minnesotans are not aware of that. Mm-hmm. And so the clarity that you are asking for legislation, I don't think necessarily would be in the political battle of what the specific legislation is there, but what's the clarity on the issue that we could weigh in maybe through a committee that's a political committee that gets information on polling and kind of information and public perceptions and can provide a clarity here is, for example, one term that we could use. This is what it means. Why don't we use that kind of thing?
Thank you, Ms. Contreras.
Well, I just want to add and just piggyback to what Senator Gimsey had said, was just the appreciation to be able to have these open and honest conversations about the issues. And, you know, going back to getting to the clarity point of the proposed legislation or discussing the executive orders, I think what's really critical, and I see it really from an economic standpoint, some from a social standpoint, we get about 150,000 calls for legal services from immigrants a year. But from an economic standpoint, I see this as critical because I see some of the fallout really harming some of the rural communities and the tax base. And, you know, what we do at Central Legal is we track enforcement very closely across the country. We don't track enforcement for the sake of tracking enforcement against unauthorized immigrants, but we track enforcement because we see that there are – enforcement doesn't occur in a vacuum, that there are economic and social fallouts. A good example was that the Genio store had a 75% drop in workforce after the raids occurred in Willmar area. Now, that's an important point to make because at the end of the day, what we want to look at is, again, what we all value, which is a strong economy, strong communities, and whether or not some of the things that are currently before the state, perhaps some legislation, perhaps the executive orders, to see how those are really playing into the things that we're really hoping to accomplish, which is healthy communities, healthy economy. So that's part of the reason why I think we could have those conversations, even if they're not necessarily appearing to be caustic, but really looking at sort of those pros and cons again to really fully understand the realities of what is occurring across the state of Minnesota.
We have 5 minutes to make this decision, and we need to hear from everyone. Representative
right.
Hamilton.
I'll just be quick. But that's exactly where you're wanting to go as well, I believe, as far as we need to not only understand the economics piece and everything else, but we also need to know and understand what the underlying issues are there out there in these communities with so we can address them both. Does that make sense? You know, some of the legislation that you're talking about is addressing a lot of the concerns that people have in different communities that are now experiencing immigration that they never experienced before. And so we need to understand that as well. And so that's where this group, if we don't take a harsh political stance on it, we should assist state government to foster an understanding, the pros and the cons. Just like you said, I think you summed it up very, very well.
Mr. Saver wanted to say something.
Madam Chair, a couple of things. One of the things I was interested was John mentioned the Illinois Office of New Americans, and I'm not adverse to borrowing good practices that have already been established that may help us build a foundation for what we're trying to get done here. So there may be some good things from Illinois and other states, so I'd be interested in finding out what those are. We can do some of our own work. Secondly, I think it would be incumbent on this group to put together, as a suggestion maybe for our next round, is I think we need to put together what our true objectives are. We have somewhat of a mission here, and I think we can articulate that mission statement. But I'm used to putting together then objectives with measurables. We have a year, we have a time, we know what we're going to be doing. And my suggestion is the group to get a tight list of objectives, not have a rambling list of objectives, but rather tight list of objectives, because we only have so much time, we only have so much resources, and that would help us better, I think, stay on track and focus on what we really want to deliver. So we think about what are we going to deliver at the end here, and if we can make them somewhat measurable, et cetera, it would be helpful. So maybe we go back now, each of us, and start putting down some of those objectives. Maybe put them into a central location, and then we get back and look at those objectives, and then I'm sure many of them are going to be similar, and we can maybe get this narrowed down so we have those in front of us so we can use those as our guiding document as we move forward.
I think that's an excellent suggestion. So do we come to you to deliver that information?
I've
lost
here.
In terms of logistics. I know that if I said send it to my office, my legislative aide will just go crazy, but how do we handle the logistics? I think this is an excellent suggestion, because that's precisely what I think we're trying to do, but it's going to be impossible for us to finish here. So if each of you please take the time to really think about what are the objectives that we truly want to accomplish through this committee, and any suggestions, you know, that go along with that in terms of how to prioritize those objectives, yeah. I think that would be very, very helpful. So how do we do this in terms of logistics?
Madam Chair and members, our office is happy to help provide administrative support and accept data, collate it, put it together, and feed it back to you.
Okay.
We also have some ability to work with research staff from House Research and Senate Counsel and Research to see if they're able to do some of the homework that you've talked about here. That's a difficult task in the midst of session, because most folks are pretty tied up for the next several months. But we'll be glad to do what we can.
Yeah, we could start the process, and we'll have, you know, during the interim after the session, we will have really more time to get into this. Ms. Contreras, Mr. Keller, Mr. Curry.
Well, just a few pieces. I just wanted to offer, we'll be happy to help out in any way we can. I have a great assistant who's worked well with your assistant in the past, and so very good about exchanging information. So I am glad that there is some outside assistance. I didn't know that I wasn't aware of that. And an additional piece is the Minneapolis Foundation on March 3rd is going to be hosting a statewide conversation around embracing immigration. I've seen the material that they've put together for the event. It's excellent. It's going to be at the Minneapolis Convention Center. You can find it on their website. There's going to be some excellent material around the ethnic heritage of our state. But in addition to that, they have at least RSVP'd for the convention site 800 people already who have common interest and shared values around this conversation. And so whoever on this table would like to be a part of that, I would be happy to get you a ticket to the door if you're interested.
It would be wonderful if all of us could go.
I could get you tickets to all of you if you'd like.
I don't know where we're at in terms of where we will be in terms of session, but I think it'll be great if we could attend together.
I looked at the invite, and it was at the same time as the House session, I think.
Is it the House session? Yeah. Okay.
But we will, you know, we should give that information. Ms. Contreras, if you could email that information to us, that would be great.
My business card is in here, too, if you want to get that information. I could just.
So for those who are able to attend, I think this will be an excellent opportunity. Mr. Keller and Mr. Corey, and we have to wrap up.
Just getting back to perhaps bifurcating the objectives due to the reality of the session, I think one of the issues that I run into, and perhaps the elected officials may also know this or have experienced it, is that there's very little knowledge of this working group by elected officials. I would propose, whether or not this is feasible, it is a suggestion that during session, to serve as a resource during session to legislators and in the immediate sort of next step, to provide knowledge of the working group and to set us out as a resource for folks who are especially interested or feel that their constituents especially want them to take something on regarding immigration, to use this as a place where we can serve to provide some information about that. I see that as, you know, a very short window of time that perhaps not all of us would be focused on. But I think it could also serve for what many of us have talked about is a relief valve in some ways to deal with what many people are seeing and probably everybody unanimously sees as the immediate priorities of this session do not include immigration. They include taxes and transportation. And if it was a possibility to set out a letter perhaps from the chair saying, for your information, members, this working group exists. This is our charge as it was set out. We would be happy over the course of the next year to take on issues and to vote on issues that members would like to deal with in terms of immigration. I could see it as a relief valve and also help us to set our agenda, at least in the legislative subgroup here, the policy subgroup of this working group.
Mr. Keller, It's kind of hard for me. I'm new to the legislature. As you know, I just got elected, so I really don't know the logistics of it. But there is a committee that was created already within the legislature to kind of look into this. I believe that it is under Senator Rest's committee. I don't know exactly how that came about, but I think that it is related to the nature of some of the proposals that are coming with respect to mandate to local government. I'm not really very versed on that. What is these groups' authority with respect to providing that? I don't know, but I will ask. So in terms of how do we, and the other thing that I'm concerned about is the timing of it, too. I don't know how do we facilitate that. I do think that we could certainly write a letter as co-chairs of these committees to let everybody know that this group is in place and that we are putting together information that may be of interest and value to their legislative pursuits. And I think we certainly could do that. But we'll definitely investigate. I don't know, in terms of logistics of how they come to this group to kind of have a hearing, for instance, I don't know if that will be possible because of the nature of these sessions just so short. But I don't think we can bring that to a hearing. I don't think it's going to work logistically, but we will be. I think we could do the letter.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So three questions,
Madam Chair. Three questions.
I think Mr. Corey had.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And we need to end.
Your suggestion that maybe we should have the full councils of colors kind of resource staff the commission too, because they're a good resource, and that I just want to give an example of what John was mentioning about how we could play a role. I have an economic model. It's kind of a standard one brought out by a group called EMSI. I put in this a typical kind of thing. What would happen if Nobles County lost 200 jobs in the food processing, in just animal slaughtering, food processing? And that will run up and say, well, it may 400 other jobs would be lost, and these industries would be impacted. But the point that we are trying to raise would be, are policymakers thinking about the consequences? And is there planning around consequences? Without us taking a position on a topic, we are helping people to think through an issue.
Very good. Just quickly, response to the councils. I don't know if you were aware that we had an event yesterday. We are putting together a resolution that I will present to the Senate on Monday. To encourage collaboration between the legislature and the councils of color. They presented a draft of the resolution yesterday. The four councils of color were here, as well as the ombudspersons for families presenting that resolution. They had a cultural event. The intent is to really make sure that everybody who works with immigrant communities and communities of color will be working with us. And so I will send an invitation on our behalf to the councils and the ombudspersons to attend these meetings so that they can contribute, because they have an incredible amount of information, like Senator Gimsey alluded to the Chicano Latino Affairs Council, that we could really use. Representative Hamilton, and we need to close.
I just would like to know the email address and where we send our objectives and by when, and the next date and when we're meeting.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members, our office has, I think, the email addresses for all of you, and we will send a routing slip with all of those to you so you can contact each other directly. And again, we will be glad to continue serving as a conduit for organizing meetings, scheduling those.
Wonderful. And Friday may be the day of preference, simply because those are the days where we don't have session, and we, at least in the Senate, we don't have committee meetings, committee hearings. I don't know about the House. Representative Gardner, Representative Hamilton, I guess you go 7 days a week,
either.
24 hours a day. Okay, so maybe Fridays, maybe if that's okay with the group, we will continue to try with Fridays, and we will let you know about the next date. And thank you so much for... hopefully in the morning. Yes.
Madam Chair, one minor logistic item for the public members. You are eligible under the resolution to receive per diem and reimbursement for expenses, and there's a form in your folders to complete if you'd like to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.
Very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Just wait.
Bet you think so.